This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. I'm Kate Forrester, here with you for the next hour. And coming up a little later in the program, I'm actually going to take you up to Port Hedland in the Pilbara, where you're going to hear about an ambitious plan from an Aboriginal-owned and managed company that wants to set up a date farm, believe it or not.
This kind of formed while doing a trek through Kariyarra country up at Aberdoth Station. Up there we have a lot of date palms that are actually just growing wild along the creek beds. So, wow, if these things are just growing beautifully up here without any intervention or any encouragement, it'd be interesting to see what we could do if we were actually nurturing these palms and seeing what we could actually create out of it.
So that story coming up after the headlines and the weather at halfway point today. But to begin with, Meat and Livestock Australia has just released its official lamb and beef production figures for the last quarter. Now, they're based on data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and it seems like the future is looking pretty bright when it comes to prices, and Australia is continuing to produce record amounts of beef. Steve Bignall manages market information for MLA. Steve, what's the biggest takeaway from today's report?
I think it's that from a beef perspective, it's records after records in terms of production and slaughter. And then from a producer's perspective, that they're receiving quite a record amount of money from processors for the animals that they're sending to processors. So they're the big takeaways from a beef perspective.
So good news for beef production. What about sheep? Is it as positive for them?
Definitely. So what we're seeing, sheep production and slaughter has dropped as the flock gets smaller, based on seasonal conditions in the East Coast and sort of the flock dynamic in WA, but they're receiving record amounts for the sheep that they send to processors.
All right, well, we'll come back to the sheep industry in a moment. Let's start with the beef industry, because you just pinpointed that we've got record after record coming in, and this quarter we had that national record in beef production. What is these records and what is driving it?
Yeah, so we've had nationally, at the moment, we've already produced 2 million tonnes of beef, which is nearly how much we produced in the whole year last year. And it's being driven nationally by just, we've had essentially 4 to 5 good years across the country. I know there's localities that have not had rain, such as sort of the southeast of the country. But nationally, the season's been good for 5 years. There's a big herd, over 30 million, and we're just turning those animals off now. It's not really a drought-induced turnoff. It's just the size of the herd is as big as it is because of successive good years, and that's leading to high beef production.
And it's the highest since 2008, isn't it?
So in WA, it's the highest since 2008, and it's an all-time record in for Australia, beating last year.
How much of this, though, Steve, is price-driven versus volume-driven, if we look at what beef farmers have made nationally?
Yeah, so last quarter, so for the 3 months from July to September, farmers took home $5.5 billion, that is beef farmers in Australia, from processors, and that's an all-time record. So that is well up on what it was last year.
And what does this tell us about where the cattle industry is headed?
I think it's really good. So what it shows is, from a WA perspective, most the average price for animals being sent to a processor is nearly $1,900. And it's interesting, we're getting record prices, or close to record prices, when we're producing record amounts of beef, which means that the prices are being supported by strong demand. So international demand, the US herd rebuild and the lack of production there is really helping stabilise prices and livestock prices right along the supply chain when you wouldn't usually expect to. So normally with the amount of beef we're producing, you wouldn't expect prices to be as high as they are.
Well, on yesterday's Country Hour, we heard about those US tariffs over the weekend being dropped from Australia, that 10% tariff. Was that having any influence on these numbers we're seeing?
No, so clearly not. So the fact that production is an all-time record, it's just being driven by supply. And what that means is that the demand in the US is so strong for beef, tariff or non-tariff, that they're buying our beef. That the US is expected to be 1.4 million tonnes short of beef this year. And so they're buying it from everywhere in the world. And that's a really good position for Australian beef farmers to be in.
All right, now what about if we pivot to look at where the sheep and lamb sector is at? What did today's report highlight there?
It showed that the average price that WA sheep farmers are making for animals that they're sending to processors is $196 a head, which is a record. And it shows that the amount of money that WA producers are making is really strong, $156 million for the quarter, but that has been caused by high prices because supply has fallen. Supply of throughput of both lambs and sheep and the amount of meat that they produce has fallen, but prices have remained high.
Fallen by how much?
So quite significant. So WA lamb production is actually the lowest it's been since September 2020, and sheep slaughter for WA is down 38% on last year. It shows where the WA flock is in terms of its cyclical nature. So the WA sheep flock is smaller than what it may historically have been, which means that there's a lower pool or a lower supply of animals available to process. But WA's had a really good year. We've got a report coming out soon that'll show sentiment, and it shows that 50% of producers are looking to increase their flock going forward. So I think we've got a small flock in WA, but it does show that producers are looking to increase going forward.
So what you're saying at the end of the day is if you've stuck in the sheep market, you're in a pretty good position right now.
Going forward, yeah, where prices are at the moment, supply is really constrained. I mean, nationally, if we look nationally, we're talking about a shortage of lamb, sheep and sheep meat, but actually it's going to be the second highest amount of lamb produced on record, only behind last year. But because processors have made a huge investment in growing their infrastructure to meet the sort of over 25 million animals processed last year, the dip back to 23 million this year is a reduction of 10%, but it's still about higher than any other year. But it shows that the supply chain has really invested in capacity, and they're looking for sheep and they're looking for lambs. And so that demand for lambs will remain strong going forward.
If we look to the next quarter, I mean, you just talked about then going forward, but if we look to the next quarter, what are you expecting to come from that? Where are we headed?
Well, we're already halfway through the quarter, so the data that's released by the ABS is sort of released 6 weeks into the quarter. From what we're seeing, our end beef production, beef slaughter will continue to be at record levels this year. We're already going to smash the beef production record set last year. We already know that lamb slaughter is sort of tapering off this year. So we know that the lamb cohort was smaller in 2025 and that supply is going to remain tight for lamb into 2026. And we've seen prices remain pretty elevated for both proteins. So it's a pretty good outlook for both livestock sectors.
Steve, thank you so much for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thanks, Kate.
Steve Bignall is the Manager of Market Information from Meat and Livestock Australia. And I am interested to hear from you today. What did you make of that data that you just heard of? Does it fill you with optimism, more confidence? Or, for instance, if you decided to get out of sheep, are you wishing you stayed with it, hearing those projections? Let me know on the text line 0448 922604.
The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
14 past 12 on the Country Hour, and between now and 1 o'clock, I will take you to Mouchet, where sheep numbers were well down at the sale yards, almost half the number that sold from last week. So just before one, Terry Birkin will be along to run you through those prices. But for now, at two farms in Western Victoria yesterday, groups of more than 50 farmers blocked access to VicGrid staff. Now, VicGrid is a Victorian government agency which is responsible for planning and developing new infrastructure that will transport energy generated by renewables to the electricity grid. But as Angus Furley explains, the farmers were protesting against the agency's first attempt to use compulsory access powers.
Access denied! 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 Access denied!
That was the sound greeting two VicGrid employees yesterday afternoon when they arrived at a farm east of Witchyproof in an attempt to force access. There were similar scenes on a property at Greens Creek near Stawell. Those employees were there to do environmental surveys for the deeply controversial VNI West transmission line project. But those surveys didn't go ahead. The group of farmers stood behind a locked gate in front of a wall of hay bales and made their views clear. Among them was farm owner Greg Roberts, who read a short statement to VicGrid staff.
I do not consent to this land today.
Okay.
Would you like me to repeat it?
I think I've got that loud and clear, yeah.
Well, today we had information from TCV, which is now VicGrid, that they were coming to compulsorily access our land for survey purposes. We'd had the paperwork coming in recent weeks. And we received our 48-hour notice to say that they were coming. We don't want this project, and we think that the urgent need for the environmental work lacks credibility. It's a desperate act because they've got time constraints. What next step is after the day, we don't know, but I'm really very, very grateful for everyone that came. And there'll be another day, I assume, in the future, and we'll have to deal with that at the time, and there was no need for the police to intervene because all of the wonderful country and town people, and some people travel a long distance. They all came here to be peaceful. I'm absolutely clear that they got the message because it was very concise.
And where to from here?
Well, only time will tell, Angus. I dare say they'll try again, whether it is at this access gateway, time will only tell. But I think we made it perfectly clear that they're not welcome.
And at the end of the day, Greg, what actually happens? Because they bought these powers, and they've got these legal rights to get onto your land. So what happens at the end of the day?
Well, we've been told that that they've got the right to start issuing fines. And if you disobey an access order, then there is a process where they can hand you a summons and take you to court. Now, that's all the threatening things that have been, waved over our head, and we'll just have to see how things pan out.
Are people going to get arrested, go to jail?
Well, it's quite possible. If they keep crushing rural people and keep harassing them with these claims for urgent and access to our farms, then people will not accept it. Time will tell. That's all I can say.
Under strengthened compulsory access powers recently enacted in Spring Street, VicGrid could seek court orders to gain access to private property. Those court orders would permit the use of reasonable force. VicGrid did not say what its next steps would be, but in a statement, Chief Executive Alistair Parker reiterated the preference for voluntary access agreements. But with the expected completion date for VNI West already pushed back 2 years to the end of 2030, it seems likely many more events like what happened yesterday are still to come.
Access denied! Access denied! Access denied!
Angus Verley with that report. What are your thoughts on that protest against a government agency exercising its compulsory access powers? Let me know on the text line today. The number again is 0448 922 604. 19 past 12. Well, this morning, Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins has criticised the recent move by the Federal, Nationals and Liberals to walk away from net zero targets. Minister Collins has also defended the government's work on net zero for agriculture, saying it's what the industry wants.
when you've got the National Farmers Federation, you know, organisations like Dairy Australia, Wine Australia, you know, and industry groups trying to reduce their emissions because they understand this is important, not just locally in terms of our environment and what we're trying to do with net zero, but also in terms of international trading partners, given that the large percentage of our produce actually gets exported overseas. So it is really important. And unfortunately, what we're seeing from the Liberals and the Nationals is that they are all over the place. I mean, we had a wasted decade last time they were in government. They still don't know what they're subsidising or not subsidising, whether it's coal or what other types of industries. And instead, we're just getting on with the job and we're working with farmers on the ground to help them reduce their emissions. And that's what we're about.
If you lose government, essentially, and a lot of these things are really long term in terms of what you're doing to try and reduce emissions, so where does that leave agriculture?
Well, obviously, it puts, you know, Australia's agriculture at risk because, as I said, 80% of it is exported into international markets. And it's in our international customers and markets that are demanding more lower emissions, high quality produce. And Australia has some of the lowest emissions on the planet already when it comes to agriculture. And we should be incredibly proud of our farmers and what they've achieved. I mean, when you look at the red meat industry, for instance, since 2005, they've reduced their emissions almost 78%. I mean, that is extraordinary. We've got some of the lowest use of fertiliser on the globe. We should be celebrating our farmers and we should be supporting them. They're some of the most productive farmers on the globe with some of the lowest emissions. And that's what our government wants to do. We'll let the other side continue to fight amongst themselves and work out what they're doing, but we're going to just get on with the job and work with farmers on the ground.
What is agriculture's role in the government's push to net zero?
Well, obviously, agriculture does play a part, but we're not setting any targets specifically for agriculture. We've got an economy-wide target and we're working right across the economy. But certainly, as I've said, you know, farmers understand that the changing climate is impacting them and their bottom line. I mean, they are trying to reduce their emissions because they know that actually they're improving their productivity on farm.
Agriculture is part of the economy, though. So it essentially is part of the targets by proxy, yeah?
That's right. Well, obviously, we want to reduce emissions across the entire economy. That's right.
Which leads me to the next question. We've got farmers protesting today, locking gates on workers from transmission companies wanting to build transmission lines on their properties to take power from renewable energy sources to the grid. This is a debate between that and mineral sands mines and so much which is about transitioning the economy to a lower emissions that is involving agricultural land use at the moment. Can anything be done there to better manage that transition? Because at the moment in regional Victoria, it feels particularly angry.
Yeah, and we've had a chat on your program before about those land use tensions and the fact that they have been there for a long time, Warwick. We've also had a chat before that, you know, we do think that the consultation can always be improved and done better. I mean, certainly a lot of farmers are benefiting and have a lot of renewable projects on their land and they're diversifying their income and they're getting the benefit from it. But also lowering emissions more broadly across on farm is actually helping farmers with their own productivity and their own bottom line. I mean, some of the modelling that ABARES in my department have done has shown that, you know, climate change is impacting farm profits, but if we actually reduce our emissions, we can improve productivity and improve returns for farmers. So we needn't lose sight of that. And that's the story that we're telling. And we're in Victoria today talking to farmers on the ground about it.
What do you say to communities that are angry about some of these renewable developments in their areas about that transition that they're involved in?
Well, obviously, we appointed the transmission commissioner, the infrastructure commissioner, which is the former CEO of the NFF, to work with local communities and to do better consultation, particularly with the energy companies. As I've said, certainly that consultation can always be improved. What I would say more broadly is the vast majority of Australian farmers and indeed Australians support net zero. I would also say that, you know, it is the cheapest form of energy, new energy. And frankly, everybody, the CSIRO modelling, everybody says it's the cheapest form of new energy, and that's what we need to be investing in.
And your energy commissioner says there needs to be more watertight rules around rehabilitating farmland, particularly as programs become to the end of their life. Is that something you want the government to look at?
Well, we're also working, obviously, with farmers and people on land about improving biodiversity and what role the Australian Carbon Credit Units or ACCUs have in terms of biodiversity as well. So we're also doing that work as well.
Agriculture Minister Julie Collins speaking to Warwick Long. And on the text line, a couple of you are wanting to have your say about that story and what you just heard from the Agriculture Federal Minister, Minister Collins. On the text line, Helen says, are people aware of the 2023 research in China? 8 wind farms showing a drying effect both upwind and downwind of turbines in grasslands. In an already drying climate, this is far from ideal. Thank you, Helen. And then Ralph says, who is this goose? We export everything that creates emissions, which only benefits the buyer, not Australia. Another activist. And then another person has texted in to say 78% reduced emissions. Where do they get these figures from? And if you don't mind just putting your name and location when you send a text in, it's always good to hear where you might be listening to the Country Hour from around the state.
Across Western Australia, this is the Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
And if you feel like having your say on the text line today about any story you've heard, please do so. The number is 0448 922 604. Well, on a completely different topic, Minister Collins has also confirmed samples of the suspected first case of H5N1 bird flu from an Australian territory are on their way to the mainland for testing. In recent years, over 1 million chickens have been killed trying to control bird flu in Australia. But so far, we have not been affected by the dreaded H5 strain, which can spread to mammals and it can even kill humans. But recently, some dead elephant seals were found on an Australian external territory, which is called Heard Island. It's just over 4,000 kilometres southwest of Perth. It's suspected the seals died from bird flu, and Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins has confirmed samples from the seals have arrived now in Hobart, and from there what's going to happen is they will be sent under strict biosecurity protocol to Victoria for testing.
Yes, they certainly arrived back on the Noyena from the sub-Antarctic island, Heard Island, where we saw that unusual high number of deaths in the elephant seals, and those samples have come back. They will be, clearing customs and going through biosecurity and being transported, and they'll go to the Centre for Disease Preparedness to be tested. We expect those tests will take a couple of weeks, and then we'll be in a position to confirm or with relief, I guess, if it's not the bird flu H5 virus, but certainly indications are that it is likely to be, and it would not be unexpected for it to be. And we have seen it on some of the French subantarctic islands a few hundred kilometres away from Heard Island. But let me just remind your listeners that this does not mean that we have the H5 here in Australia. It is an external territory and it's quite some distance from Australia.
Yeah, well, in fact, bird flu would be closer in some Asian countries than this territory is to the Australian mainland.
All of the experts advise me we are more likely to get it from the north. We can't stop it from coming, unfortunately, Warwick, because it will come via migratory birds. So we have done everything that we can do. We have invested early. We have provided additional resources to states and territories and work with industry and other groups. We've done exercises. So we're prepared as much as we can be for when it does arrive in Australia at some point in the future. We hope it's some time in the future, though. So we'll continue to keep our eye out, and I'd remind people if they see large groups of dead birds, please do not touch them, but please go to birdflu.gov.au and or ring the hotline there that you'll find on that webpage, because we do need to be notified if there are any sightings of it so that we can get testing done immediately.
Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins speaking to Warwick Long. And as the Minister just said, if you do suspect any sightings, you can head to birdflu.gov.au and find more information there. Mike from Boyartbrook has texted in and says, Minister Collins continues to spew the same old Labor rhetoric. I have come across one farmer who agrees with net zero. Thank you, Mike, for your text. Please do text in if you've got something to say. On the text line, it's 0448 922 604. 28 past 12, coming up to the headlines at 12:30. But before we get there, this morning a truck carrying a load of grain rolled over on a roundabout in Narrogin in the Great Southern this morning. Scott Summers was one of the first on the scene at the rollover and says the driver is okay, but it might be a little while before everything is cleaned up.
I rocked up just after it and the cops were already there, and a guy has... The trailers have gone off the side of the roundabout. There's kind of a stream that goes underneath, and all of the grain is spilling into the stream. And the guy's okay. He was sitting out on the curb when I got there.
But the grain is gone?
Yeah, it looks like most of it is. I don't know how long it's going to take them to clean it up. It's the both trailers are down in the ditch on the side of the roundabout.
Whereabouts?
And the truck is up on its side.
Okay. Whereabouts exactly, Scott?
At the roundabout, the main big roundabout in Narrogin.
I'm glad to hear the driver is fine.
Yeah, he said his Apple Watch called emergency services and everything. He said everyone just sort of rocked up. Yeah, his mum called him as well.
Scott Summers speaking to Peter Barr on the Southern Morning Show earlier today. And I actually do know the exact roundabout that Scott is talking about. So if you have been through that area today and you've got an update for us, do let me know, is the truck still there and how has traffic been affected so far on 0448 922 604. Now it is 12:30 and Jonathan Bill is in the studio with the headlines.
Thanks, Kate. The Deputy Premier says the detachment of 70 metres of lighting casing from Perth's Boorloo Bridge will not happen again. Late yesterday afternoon, a metal casing from one of the bridge's support cables fell. As a result, the bridge has been closed until at least tomorrow. Rita Saffiotti insists the government is not embarrassed by the incident, saying such things happen. The state and federal governments have announced a new water recycling facility will be built in Bunbury at a cost of $50 million. Speaking in Bunbury, the Water Minister, Don Punch, and his federal counterpart, Murray Watt, said the facility would treat wastewater so it could be used on local parks and gardens. Mr Punch says the initial project will supply the Hay Park Sporting Precinct, allowing for the preservation of valuable groundwater. And the United Nations Security Council has voted in favour of a US-drafted resolution which endorses Donald Trump's 20-point plan for Gaza. Included is the establishment of an international stabilisation force to which the US says multiple countries have offered to contribute. Hamas has rejected the resolution and says it does not meet Palestinians' rights and demands. The US ambassador to the UN, Mike Waltz, has thanked council members for backing what he calls an historic and constructive resolution. More news, Kate, at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Be part of the Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
28 to 1, and a little later on, we're going to be heading to Katanning down in the Great Southern just to check in on a little bit of an update with Ausgold, the mining company down there that plans to extract gold from some land. And they've actually now got a approval in the pipeline about a 250 worker accommodation. So we'll head there a little later on just to hear where that's at and what's that is going to mean for the community. But before we get there, Joey Rawson is going to bring me up to date with what's happening around the state with the weather. Joey, let's start in the north of the state today, because in the past few days there's been a fair bit going on. What's the update?
Yeah, hi Kate. It's quite interesting in the north in the short term and in the long term. In the short term, there's not a lot of activity going on. We might get some just isolated thunderstorms on that kind of northwest coast for a number of days. However, the broad part of the Kimberley, Pilbara and North Interior may not get much. So that is interesting within itself in the short term, but in the long term, there is the potential for this tropical low that will most likely turn into a tropical cyclone over the next 24 hours, and that potentially may drift towards the northern Kimberley sometime on the weekend. Fair bit of uncertainty at this point, and when that happens, and if that does happen, then the rainfall will certainly pick up. So in the short term, not heaps going on, and in the long term, maybe a lot going on, Kate, in the north of the state.
I mean, you mentioned that it could turn into a tropical cyclone. First thought that came to my mind just then, Joey, what's the name?
We haven't named it yet, so we'll wait until it's named, and I think it will be named certainly by tomorrow morning at this stage, so we'll wait and see, Kate.
Do we know what letter we're up to, though?
No, I don't know, actually, no.
Well, we'll wait and we'll have to see what happens overnight. Let's move to the south of the state now, Joey. Yesterday, Angeline was telling me that there could have been a little bit of dry lightning around grain-growing areas and other parts of the state. Is that still the case?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of thunderstorm activity going on around the Southwest Land Division, including kind of the Central Wheat Belt, and also moving into kind of the Great Southern, and there's also a fair bit of thunderstorm activity through the Gascoyne at the moment. It was more drier type thunderstorms yesterday, so thunderstorms that don't produce much rain. Most of the rain evaporates before it hits the ground. However, there's moisture streaming in from the north, which means that if we do get thunderstorms, then there's more of a chance of that rain hitting the ground. The more moisture gets, the more rain that we could get on the ground. And the key is we're going to have thunderstorms through the Southwest Land Division for a number of days. So today, all the way through to potentially Saturday before this feature that's kind of driving these storms moves out to the east. So yeah, some of the falls may be up there as we track forward. We could be getting thunderstorms of producing, 20 to possibly 40 millimetres as we move forward. So the only chance of lightning actually striking the ground and causing some fires if a bolt of lightning goes out away from the rain, if you know what I mean. So, but as we track forward, it's more likely going to be associated with quite wet thunderstorms. And there could be some severe thunderstorms around, not just for today, but also for the next kind of 2 to 3 days. So, yeah, please keep an eye on the warnings on the Bureau's webpage, because once we see things that are starting to form up that look quite sinister, then we'll put out a warning accordingly.
You mentioned rain, but are we expecting any hail?
There is a chance of hail, certainly the chance of hail through kind of the central west today and also for tomorrow. So, yeah, the next couple of days there is the potential for some hail and slight potential that hail could be quite big in nature. So, yeah, a lot going on in the weather space.
Thanks for bringing us up to date, Joey.
No worries.
Richard Hudson making his way into the studio to go over the rainfall figures for us from yesterday up until 9 o'clock today. Richard?
Yeah, mostly in the north. So in the Kimberley, there wasn't any actually, but in the Pilbara, Marble Bar 12, Yarry had 9 mils, and then in the Gascoyne, Mount Clare 9, Mount Narrier 6, and Cherry Creek 9. Nothing in the Goldfields or the interior, and then in the Southwest Land Division, there wasn't too much around. Except in the central west, Bellandine 7, Carnamar and Coolangatta Alert Station 5, Geraldton 6, Greengrove 12, Mowiscar 6, Morowa, Port Denison and Three Springs all recorded 5, and Yandanooka 8. And then in the central wheat belt, a little bit around the Wongan Hills area, just north of there, one of the rain gauges tipped out 3 mils, but that was about it.
Okay. Now, Richard, before you run off, I want to take a minute of your time to offer you a formal apology after yesterday's Country Hour, because you were reading out the rainfall figures and you likened one station name to the band The Pixies in what I referred to or responded to you saying, "What is that?" And I just thought after the show that I need to say sorry, because it really showed my age. And I went home and I looked up what the Pixies sang. A friend even sent me a message to say they were disappointed. So I just thought it's worthwhile to say I'm very sorry for not knowing that. I will do better.
You do not have to apologise. But just to give you a tiny insight, certainly not a pop band, but when Nirvana was saying that the Pixies are probably one of the most their most influential bands, you know they're pretty big.
And I want to step in here because I know exactly what you're going to say, because I did homework. And Nirvana, Kurt Cobain, said that he was trying to recreate a Pixie song with the Is It Smells Like Teen Spirit? No. Is that the
song?
Possibly,
yeah.
Because Pixies always go a really soft introduction, loud, and then soft to finish off with. So I think I did my homework and I think I've earned some respect back.
I was looking at some of the Pixies songs that are on my like list on Spotify, and some of them are like, one's called Chicken, one's called Oyster Beds. I reckon the Pixies are clearly country hour listeners.
Absolutely. Well, tune in tomorrow to Kate Forrester's music facts that she didn't know 24 hours ago.
Mind you, another one is Where Is My Mind? So, yeah, that proves they are country hour listeners.
Well, in other news, an Aboriginal-owned and managed company wants to set up a date farm at Port Hedland. Bidari WA director Terry Beath believes there's room in the market because Australia currently imports most of the dates you see in the supermarket. But he also wants to see some new industries in the Pilbara.
We're always trying to understand gaps within the market, especially in the Pilbara. I'm a Kariyarra person from Port Hedland, so everything is all about the mining industry and iron ore, I suppose, up in Port Hedland. It was looking at what we can do that may, or where the Port Hedland climate and the Pilbara climate, I guess, from a wider perspective, may have some other opportunities. And it just happened to be looking at a few different agriculture options. The climate tended to be quite suitable for dates. At the moment in Australia, we generally import, give or take, between 7,000 and 9,000 tonnes of dates a year, which is quite substantial, and that's growing on a year-to-year basis. However, in Australia, we only produce around about 150 tonnes. Given that the climate there, we've got reasonable soil types, and we've got some very excited and interested and dedicated date farms around Australia, it just seemed like it was a no-brainer in a way.
Right, so we're importing a lot of dates from overseas, but there aren't actually many in Australia that are being grown.
Not at all. I think roughly at the moment there's between 50 and 60 farms that are producing about 150 tonnes annually. This kind of also formed while doing a trek along through Kariyarra country up at Abydos Station. Up there we have a lot of date palms that are actually just growing wild along the creek beds. So, wow, if these things are just growing beautifully up here without any intervention or any encouragement, it'd be interesting to see what we could do if we were actually nurturing these palms and seeing what we could actually create out of it.
Where are you at with the project now?
So we've just about finished the research stage. The research has been quite comprehensive. One, to look at the climate, look at the local soil types. Water is obviously a big consideration. And what we wanted to do is look at it slightly differently to how date farms have been operating in the past. We wanted to see if we could somehow create more of a circular economy. To me, making sure that we have those kind of options to create those circular economies is quite important to me as a Kariyarra person. And I think it's just important that whatever we take, we can kind of give so we minimise that impact both on the environment but also economically as well. At the moment, we are just about at that point where we'll be looking for funding to actually just acquire the first batch of date palms. So we're looking at probably a total investment of around $60,000. And then that would probably be the extent of it for the short term. And then once they're in, it'll, you know, the shareholders and family members who are going to be looking after it over the few years while we watch the date palms mature, I suppose.
They take quite a while to mature, is my understanding, Terry. Is it 4 to 7 years from seeding before they begin fruiting, and then it's another 7 to 10 years for yields to improve and sort of stabilise?
That's exactly it. And that could have been a major inhibitor as to why the Australian date palm industry is still developing. There's quite a decent time frame or a lead time between, you know, planting them and seeing some kind of return. The sooner, I suppose, we get these date palms in, the sooner we can start to prove our research and our concept, which hopefully will then lead to other date farms being established across WA or across the Pilbara region.
Which market would you be mainly supplying? Would you just be focusing on WA or Australia or even shipping some dates overseas?
So initially the WA market, just because we do have a net import into Australia, you know, which is quite substantial, but there's also additional complications as well for a lot of the date farms that have to export across into Australia. They are subject to biosecurity. So you're looking at additional costs to transfer those pellets over, whereas the demand across Australia is actually quite large. So we'd be hoping to initially focus on just the WA market. However, I guess Perth is in a very unique and prime position where we could support both the Middle East and Asian markets as well. Should this project be successful and we see substantial growth, then we're very lucky in Perth where we have multiple flights a day going into Singapore, to Dubai, across the Middle East, across Malaysia as well. So, yeah, initially WA, but long-term, potentially into the Asian and Middle Eastern markets. Just on that too, we're also quite lucky, I suppose, in Perth, because majority of the dates that are produced across the world are actually produced in the Northern Hemisphere. So it's an opposite season to what we have in terms of our harvest season. It creates another unique opportunity for the international market, so to speak, where we would be able to potentially provide fresh dates in the off-season to the Northern Hemisphere.
Just to add another fun little thing that you guys are looking at with this project, normally after you enjoy a date, you toss the seed in the bin, or maybe if you're so inclined, you eat the seed. I've never heard of that being a thing, but most people would toss the seed in the bin. But you guys are hoping to process the seeds into something quite special. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, so we've been doing a bit of research, and again, this comes back to the circular economy, and we want to, you know, try and strive for zero waste. And we've found there's been some research into the use of date stone activated carbon. Now, this carbon seems to be, through early research, an incredible filter for water systems, including rivers and lakes. So what we are hoping to do is the low quality or the discarded dates, we would be intending to essentially separate them and use the date stone itself, turning them into activated carbon, while the pulp or flesh would be utilised to become essentially like a high energy fodder for cattle. So that's pretty much the longer term vision and longer term objective. But we'd love to come up with that solution for date stone activated carbon. We understand the river systems, you know, have the potential to be polluted through the wide array of mine sites that exist across the Pilbara. And this would be a way where we feel that we would be able to actually do our bit, and we'd be working on, you know, supporting traditional owner Indigenous Ranger programs, you know, with their own water programs to help do what we can, I suppose.
Budari WA Director and Founder Terry Beath speaking with Amelia Searson about the date farm they're keen to get up and running in the Pilbara. And Terry says if all goes well, securing the $60,000 funding that they're after, they could get this Turner River date farm up and running as early as next year. Budari WA is an Aboriginal owned and managed company that develops unique projects in the Pilbara. 14 to 1.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Ausgold has reached an agreement in principle to build new workers' accommodation for its Katanning Gold project in the Great Southern. The mining company plans to construct a 250-bed housing facility on an 8-hectare site which is owned by the Shire. Ausgold Executive Chairman John Dord says building the workers' accommodation on the outskirts of town rather than at the mine site will be great for the local economy.
We've completed a definitive feasibility study, which is really sort of the, you know, a very detailed view of what the project will look like. We're actually in the process of just doing a small update to that based on we had some land access challenges in previous years, but we've now solved those, which gives us access to more land. So we're actually just updating the project, you know, the feasibility study to allow for that additional land. So expect that out before the end of the year. We've recently started drilling about 2 weeks ago, again on land that we haven't been able to access for some years. So it's all systems go.
I understand you've reached an agreement in principle with the Katanning Shire for a long-term lease for the 250-bed workers' accommodation facility. What does agreement in principle entail?
Basically, that's the key terms of the agreement. Under their sort of requirements for the local governments, they need to now advertise that, which they've been doing. So when they sort of enter into an agreement with a commercial party like us, they need to advertise that and see if anyone else wants to use that land for something. So that's, I think, might have actually finished or is very close to finishing. So we're sort of in the last bits of the sort of the formal process, but all of the sort of commercial terms have been agreed.
Right. So what needs to happen to really lock in that agreement then?
Just really need to sign the formal lease agreement, which we anticipate doing later this month.
The land that's proposed to be used for this workers' accommodation, how big of an area are we talking? And also, has that land already been cleared, or do you need to do some clearing works before construction starts?
Look, it's about, I think, and I'm just estimating, I think it's about 4 or 5 hectares. It's on the outskirts of town. It's largely cleared. There's a bit of grassland, etc. So there will be some, you know, we'll need to sort of clear the topsoil and everything and stockpile that for landscaping, but it's essentially a open paddock by and large, but you know, we'll need to sort of flatten it out a little bit so it's ready for construction, but very minimal site works required.
The accommodation is on the outskirts of town rather than being at the actual mine site 40 kilometres northeast of Katanning. Why is that, John?
Look, I mean, that was something that very early on the Shire was quite keen to see us do. Typically or traditionally, you know, mine site accommodations is built at the mine, essentially, and then, you know, workers come in and come out from there on that's the sort of the fly-in, fly-out model that a lot of your listeners would be, you know, familiar with. This is a little bit different, I think, because of the community of Katanning. You know, you've got a large town with a lot of services. They were keen for us to be integrated more into the community. So, you know, our people will be able to go shopping at the local shops. We'll get local businesses, we'll provide services, you know, food, et cetera, catering services, et cetera, like that. So I think they were sort of keen to really make sure that it just wasn't an isolated fly-in, fly-out camp with really no interaction. You know, I think they wanted to see that, you know, the close nexus to town. Longer term, and I think this is not really for the, you know, initial start-up of operations, but longer term, I fully expect that staff, you know, employees will be moving to the area and they'll bring their family. I mean, I used to work at the Stall Gold Mine in Victoria and there was no workers' camp there. Everyone lived in the town, had built town, you know, houses, had small farms on the outskirts of town or whatever. As we transition and become established, you know, people will be coming and living in town with their family as opposed to a more typical mining camp and just where everyone just flies in, flies out for their roster and then goes home.
Just back on what you mentioned when we first started talking, John, about the land access that you've gained. Was that the additional 240 hectares of land?
Look, there's been a couple of packages. So we've actually done 4 transactions in total. So we acquired 2 farms around the middle of last year for about 1,000 hectares. We then acquired, you know, we had a sort of a settlement with another group and acquired about 800 hectares in August this year, and that sort of was important land for us because that's enabled us to expand the project, you know, our footprint there. And then that piece you referred to was another piece of land to the south that hosts a small deposit that we acquired just a month or so, or, you know, 6 weeks ago, whenever it was.
What does having that extra land unlocked mean for the project?
It certainly gives the project. We think that the mineralisation continues off the historic mining lease, which we had, and onto some of that freehold land. So that was important for us. It gives us more flexibility with respect to layout. And also, I think it creates a buffer zone between us and our neighbours, which, you know, we acknowledge that as a mining operation, it's a 24/7 operation. We think it's important for us to have areas, you know, separating us from our nearest neighbours. That'll allow us to build, to plant out nature corridors, etc. So, you know, we're not going to be on top of people. We're going to have quite a bit of distance between us and our neighbours going forward.
And in terms of the timeline for this project, John, where are you at? What's happening now and what's on the agenda next?
As I mentioned, we've started drilling again on the project, so we should be able to continue to expand the project. That's, I guess, medium to long term. We are well into the permitting phase of the operation, so we need to permit this project at both the federal level and at the state level, and we're sort of engaged with both state and federal agencies on that, making significant progress there. This project has been assessed by the federal government as effectively a, you know, a low to moderate impact project. Importantly, what we're doing is we're operating this project largely on land that's been cleared, that's freehold land that's been cleared historically for farming. So we're not sort of removing large areas of bushland as part of this project. So I think that's why the sort of the regulators are starting to look at this as a fairly straightforward project. So that's key for us. We're making progress in terms of financing the project, in terms of debt to build the projects. So we're sort of heading towards a timetable where around the sort of probably around June next year, we'll make what's called a final investment decision or an FID, which is where you have all the permits in hand, all the financing in hand, all the contracts, etc., and you actually start construction formally. Following that, about an 18-month construction period, and we are hoping to have a bright, shiny Christmas present in 2027, pour gold in December 2027.
Ausgold Executive Chairman John Dord speaking with Amelia Searson.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Liberal opposition leadership rumblings across two states. A new Liberal leader for Victoria and the New South Wales Liberals ponder their own leadership spill. A robust debate in the House of Commons in the UK overnight as the British government announces new plans to overhaul the country's asylum system. Why there are now more fatal crashes involving drugs than alcohol. And Lane Beachley honoured at the Sport Australia Hall of Fame. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
Well, today coming after 1 o'clock, but Jim on the text line has actually got in touch just about that earlier story on the Aboriginal-owned company Boudary, who want to set up a date farm in Port Hedland in the Pilbara. And Jim says, Kate, dates are a great idea. I remember seeing overseas nomadic tribes surviving on almost dates alone for weeks at a time. Must be very good for everyone. And the bonus is they can be stored refrigerated. Thanks for your text, Jim. You can always get in touch on 0448 922 604. And Karen has also just texted through from Darkin just about that story about the two farms in Western Victoria yesterday where groups of more than 50 farmers blocked access to the Vic grid staff. And Karen says she can understand this community's frustrations in Victoria. Our shire is set to host multiple renewable energy and state government infrastructure, but have received zero financial support to navigate this process. And the costs to date have been borne by our community and ratepayers. Thank you for your text, Karen. 1:05, and we're going to head to Mushay now because it wasn't a very big sheep sale there this morning. Only 6,700 were sold and just under half of that were lambs. Terry Birkin's been at the sale. Hi, Terry. What can you tell me?
Hello, Kate. Numbers halved from the previous sale and again lambs with weight were limited in supply. While store lambs remained equal, the light volume of heavier grades helped lift their bellies by $15 to $20 a head. Mutton was also in demand and received improved rates regardless of weight, with bony grades gaining the most. Wethers were also keenly sought after in any frame, size and fat score, lifting $25 to $30 a head. New season store lambs ranged from $66 to $170, while air freight weights sold from $166 to $194 a head. Heavier lambs gained $15 to $20, with trade weights selling from $196 to $248, and heavy lambs returned $238 to $281 a head. Light frame merino wether hoggets sold from $130 to $158, and with more weight and wool, sold to a top of $237 a head. Only light merino ewe hoggets were yarded and ranged from $146 to $160, while crossbred hoggets started from $120 and topped at $255 a head. Boner mutton gained $10 to $15, making $120 to $188, while heavier ewes were dearer by $5 to $7 and returned $175 to $240. Wethers lifted, with light frames selling from $152 to $208 and heavy wethers from $211 to $253, while mature rams sold from $80 to $180 a head. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Terry. And today the total was 2,833 lambs, 3,869 sheep and 6,702 in total, which was down on last week by 5,851. So a pretty big drop. 2 minutes to one, and Richard Hudson is back in the studio because you've got some breaking news about the CSIRO.
Yeah, so this news just in, the CSIRO has just announced that it's going to axe up to 350 research jobs. So this is part of a major overhaul, it says, is to secure the agency's long-term sustainability. So in a statement, the scientific research body says funding just hasn't kept pace with the rising costs of running a modern science agency. And it says an 18-month review of its research portfolio found it needed a sharper focus on areas like climate resilience, clean energy and advanced technologies. So, yeah, not good news for those people who are involved in the science side of things if the CSIRO is axing 350 research jobs.
Can't imagine they're too happy at the moment. Look, on a bit of a lighter note, there's an expression, Richard, you were telling me about, tarred with the same brush, and you've been doing some research on its origins. It's been traced back to sheep farming, is that right?
Yeah, so tarred with the same brush obviously means to be part of a group regarded as having the same faults and weaknesses, but often that might be a bit of an unfair generalisation. But I've just been flicking through a book called Red Herrings and White Elephants, which looks into the origins of some of our commonly used phrases. And it says, tarred with the same brush is an old farming term which derives from the practice of treating the sores of an entire flock of sheep. This is probably well known to sheep farmers. The sores were coated by a brush dipped in tar. The same brush would be used on all stricken sheep, but never on the healthy ones for fear of passing on the infection. So all infected sheep would be tarred with the same brush.
Well, there you go. Maybe we'll have to think of another one to come up with tomorrow to gain some insight into what these mean.
I might have a cricket-related one later in the week.
Anyway, now it's 1 o'clock news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.